Hello and welcome to Under the Scales. Today I'm trying out a new episode format. For those of you playing along at home, now we have three types. The regular interview episode, that one doesn't require any explanation. Then there's the deep dive. A deep dive is what I did with Trey when we examined his guitars. For a deep dive episode, I'll have a co-host with me, and in that one, of course, you will recall that I was accompanied by the one and only Dan Cantor. So now here's a third type of episode that I'll simply call Q&A for question and answer, of course. I recently surveyed you guys, my Under the Scales Twitter and Facebook followers, asking for questions that you wanted me to take a crack at. So thank you for all those questions. For Q&A episodes, I'll have one or more guests actually asking me those questions. So here it goes. For this first Q&A episode, I'm joined by two of my best friends, Stephen Tebow Thomas and Scott Gray. All right, welcome to Under the Scales. We are in Princeton, New Jersey, and I'm with two of my favorite friends, Scott and Tebow. And we're trying a different format here for Under the Scales. These guys are going to read me some of the questions that you've sent, and there's a lot of them. I got hundreds and hundreds of questions, so we're going to go through a couple of them. All right, well, here we go. Who's first? Which of you two are going to start reading?
Tebow.
I'm just trying to find one that jumps out for our first question.
Two questions. When were you first really impressed with fish? That's the first question. Second question is, when did you know, like, holy crap, like, this is really going?
Like, when I knew it was really going, it was after Junta. It was after Lawn Boy, actually. Junta was when I kind of jumped on board again. Like, Trey and I, our relationship kind of went through ins and outs. Like, he was in Burlington and I was in Princeton. And then, you know, we got back together for various reasons. And then we went apart and got back together. After Junta came out, and that was kind of an official release of this band Fish, I honestly didn't know too much about Fish's music. I listened to it a lot. I was very into, I liked Fee, Reba, I liked Esther. I liked those complex lyrical songs, and I was kind of taken aback a little bit by You Enjoy Myself and Divided Sky and Dinner and a Movie and N2O, the lack of, say, substantive lyrics.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
And I was kind of thinking the amount of stuff that at the time I was generating, my mind was just like whirling, spewing out stuff, and I would just write it down. I just thought, you know what? Why don't I just send some of this to Trey and see if any of it takes?
Right. Instead of just Divided Sky, which you did write.
Right. Well, yeah, right.
But you're thinking like...
But that was like an addendum to an experience, so to speak. And Trey, like, you know, composed this amazing musical thing and decided to, you know, put the whipped cream on top of the ice cream cone with a tiny bit of words. But really, that one... Yeah, that one you go through a musical journey.
Yeah.
I thought maybe I could possibly compose some stuff that Trey might like to weave music to, or to, you know. And so at that point I started sending him lyrics. But it was right around then when I started just seeing them, the crowd start to grow. The fans start to grow. The faithful, you know, that they'd appear, you'd see the same people in Boston as you see in Philadelphia. And then I started realizing there's something happening here.
Yep. How many years is in that? How many years is that in? That's like we're in.
They really had like this really amazing growth spurt. So they were, I would say like 87.
Cool.
Really just growing like leaps and bounds. So they would play North Carolina for a tiny place. Then they come back, like Cat's Cradle or whatever that place was that we saw them down there. Right. Then they come back and they play a place that had to be twice the size. And they kept doing that. They kept doubling, you know.
Oh, wow. Every time we saw them. Yeah.
Yeah, but it was growing.
But it grew every time I went and saw them. It grew.
Yeah.
And it still didn't seem like they'd ever break out of bars. Not theaters. And then all of a sudden it was theaters.
Yeah.
Then all of a sudden, or clubs and theaters, and all of a sudden it just exploded.
It did. Wow.
It's kind of like that, you know, that grain of rice, you know, on a chessboard. Every time you move the grain of rice from one piece on the chessboard to another piece, you have to double it. Yes. And the next time you double it again, so it's four. So like the first couple concerts you go to, they've grown slowly. Then it's 8, you know, then it's 16. But soon, before long, it's 32,000.
You know, the reason I ask is because, you know, we all know, I mean, I have many friends who've had bands, right? And, you know, and like they start out in bars and they're doing great and you think they're great and they're doing well, but they don't just keep going, you know? So that had to be a really cool bifurcation in your like thought process of like all of a sudden you realize this is a thing, you know?
Yeah. I mean, absolutely. I think one in 1 million bands get to experience that kind of growth. You know, it must have happened to Pearl Jam. It must have happened to other bands like that. And we were just lucky that we were friends with Trey, you know, and so we know it from that side.
Right.
Cool. But yeah, it was amazing.
Right. What would you consider to be your most personal song?
I'm sort of tired of answering Pebbles and Marbles to this, because that one's definitely about my daughter, and that one's personal, and it's one of my favorite songs. So that one I answer to a variety of questions. I say Pebbles and Marbles, like, what's your favorite song you've ever written, or what's your most personal? But there's another one, Walls of the Cave, which I wrote for my son, but then someone, and his name is Trey, told me that it was actually about the World Trade Center.
Whoa, really?
Well, yeah, and yes. He caught my heart before it hit the ground.
Yes.
And if you need to know the name of all those you couldn't save, and all those things, you know, even though I was trying to leave it was about sort of being gone, and a message for my son sort of later, maybe after I'm gone or something like that. And yet, why was I in that mind frame? And it was probably because of 9/11,
right,
which had just happened when we wrote it. But I definitely wasn't attempting to write it. And I will 100% claim to my dying day that the WTC, World Trade Center, Walls of the Cave, that was an absolute 100% coincidence.
Yeah, right. that's what John Lennon said about Lucy. That's what John Lennon said about Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds.
Well, now do you believe him?
No.
Now, I actually don't. Oh, that's too bad that you say it that way.
I don't believe you.
Well, I believe me.
Okay.
I
really believe me. All right, right, right.
But yeah, so that's an intense. Those two, Pebbles and Walls, intensely personal songs.
Wow.
What is your most misunderstood lyric?
You guys got to help me here.
Most misunderstood.
Well, story-wise, Ghost, that's misunderstood.
Totally, yeah.
Like, no, but I think they mean like in,
yeah,
like, excuse me, when up, I kissed, where right, I kissed this
kiss
guy.
Kiss this guy.
Yeah. Oh, there's I a see, bathroom on the left.
Yeah.
Yeah, I see.
Yeah. There's a guy on Twitter who created a misheard fish lyrics entire fish persona. And his persona is called It's Mice Hole.
That's funny. But I did not. Maybe that's not a good question.
I didn't write that one.
I was thinking more like, someone comes up to you, thank you so much for the song Sparkle. It's so beautiful about this.
All of them.
And
yet,
it's something else.
Well, all of them. Well, let's answer it that way then. Yeah. Yeah.
All of them.
All of them.
All of them are misunderstood.
Or completely understood, because it's.
Totally misunderstood.
I think misunderstood from what I was thinking when I was writing it versus to what sort of the common thinking of what it's about, that there's frequently a disconnect there.
Yeah, I've noticed, because like since I've known you and I've learned like what these songs are about, I was like, wow, that's not how I looked at it at all. Like,
do you have
zero.
An example?
Like Sample in a Jar.
All right.
Okay. And everybody thinks of it differently. I actually heard someone just this last weekend talk about Sample in a Jar, and she said she thought it was about abortion. Okay. Well, so what's Sample in a Jar? Tell us what Sample in a Jar is about.
Oh, my God. I think it's Simple in a Jar is about reducing a relationship to a clinical scientific experiment.
Okay.
Right?
And?
Well, no, it's just like a, you know, relationship gone bad. And, you know.
That's what's left?
I'm going to wind up a sample in a jar.
That's what's left.
Yeah.
Okay, all right.
It's like, you know.
That's definitely misunderstood.
I was at a party and you know, I wheeled around because I didn't hear what you said. And there you are dancing with someone else, you know.
Oh, man.
Up on that bed. Dancing.
Free. Free is frequently misunderstood.
Free is misunderstood.
Yeah.
There was like when that first came out, there was a lot of people speculating that that was about birth. Soon I'll be free.
Yes.
And that it's like a baby traveling in the birth canal because then you're splashing and you hear a tiny cry. Wah!
Yeah.
Yeah. And then soon people read more into the lyrics like, oh, it's about killing someone, pushing them off a cruise ship. And, you know, then there's other interpretations. What mine was when I wrote it, I don't, you know, it's like I never, one of my things that I like saying is I don't want to tell you what it's about. But that one I think is more leaning toward that latter one than the former.
There you have it, ladies and gentlemen.
Or tell the and people probably know this partially, but I love your story about Down with Disease and just that you were literally. Oh, yeah.
I was down with disease for 3 weeks in my bed. It was the most amazing, perfect disease because I was in this horrible part of my job. I was at AT&T, you know, I was a programmer at AT&T, and I actually got mono. I couldn't figure out what was wrong with me. I woke up one morning, and I couldn't lift up my arms or legs, and I was kind of just like, and living alone in my apartment, and I called my mom. This was before cell phones, so I had to like get out of my bed, which was acrobatic. It was difficult. And I kind of like slithered along the floor to my mom. And I'm like, help. She's like, what's the matter, Tommy? She's Swedish, and so she has an accent. I can't do my mom's accent.
Yes,
she sounds, she sounds American to me. It's like, what's the matter, Tommy? Tommy. And she came over immediately and took me to the hospital. And I had mono badly, a bad case. I had to call work and say, and they were like, no, stay away. And so it was 3 weeks in my bed, and that's exactly when I wrote the song, and that's what it's about.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Cool.
It was a great time.
That's sort of not misunderstood, because right. We kind of get that somebody's sick.
Yeah.
Disease. I mean, it tells
you're
us
down with disease.
A little bit.
Yeah.
Can I ask a question? Could you just tell us about what Buffalo Bill's about? Because I kind of like the story. Please.
Someone just asked me if there's any song that has been sort of misunderstood over time, and then gradually they understand the meaning. And I said recently as an answer to that, that in this political climate, that Buffalo Bill has now taken on its correct meaning. but no, I don't really need to talk too much about the details of that one.
Come
right?
on, about like the situation.
Okay, so Looking for Owls.
Looking for Owls.
Yes.
What's that
right,
about?
That, like, I'll explain that. So Looking for Owls, the young man asked, hoping to lighten the tension. The scowl he received as his only reply made him laugh as he relived the mention. And the cowering fool walked on alone, quite proud of the fear he instilled. And later they found him tied to a log, bent over, and Buffalo Bill. Okay, except for that very last line, every single thing prior to that was at Educational Testing Service, where I worked. ETS.
ETS.
The people that bring you the SAT.
Great. Oh,
I had a sort of oppressive boss. And he was one of those guys. He's now departed, so I'm going to say RIP, and I'm not going to say his name. He was one of those that would do what we called bed checks. So like at 5:05, he would come walking by to make sure that everyone was still, you know, hasn't left at 5. And then at like 9:05, he did a walk to make sure that everyone was there at 9. And then he would also do a certain type of bed check to make sure that you were within your 45 hour, because they had a beautiful cafeteria there. And so you only had a 45 minute lunch hour, meaning you had to go to lunch and come back in 45 minutes. Yeah. And you really had to.
And or else this guy, he got on.
Well, he was like one of those old British school teachers. He really was. He even had a British accent. I might have betrayed who he is. But to his family, I apologize. But anyway, so he had told us a story of how he had come in early that morning and seen an amazing great horned owl. And I'm a bird fan. I love raptors. Any type of hunting bird, I'm a huge, huge fan of. Vultures, falcons, hawks, and of course owls. So when I heard this, I was like, well, that's really cool. I'm going to go out and try to find the owl that he was talking about. And I knew the path he was talking about because there's this beautiful path. ETS campus is kind of like a beautiful college campus. It's really well. But we weren't allowed to, you know, time-wise, eat lunch and then walk on the path because that would mean that we've taken more than our 45-minute time. And who should we see on the path as we're out
bed
there?
Bedcheck.
As we're out there, but Mr. Bedcheck. And so the only thing I could say to him, he was approaching us. We were busted, right? We were just fucked. It was three of us, me, Joaquin, and Barry. And we were walking toward him, and you could see that we're like, the two of them like turned white, like, oh shit, we're busted. And he walked to us, and he was like frowning, pulling the Mr. Badass routine, right? He wasn't going to say hi or anything.
Right, yeah.
And as he came by, I was kind of like, we can't just like walk by and pretend we didn't see each other.
Yeah.
like is that the douchiest thing in the world?
Yes.
Right? So I was like, you know what? I'm going to break through the doucheness of this situation. And so I said to him the one thing that I thought might be kind of okay. I said, looking for owls? Because we had that moment earlier.
Yeah, right.
And I thought he might just all of a sudden go, yes, of course, I haven't seen him. Instead, he gave me this amazing, like, I'll deal with you later scowl. A horrendous scowl.
Yeah.
Both of my friends, after he kind of disappeared, both of my friends like, why did you say that? I was like, oh my God, thinking that was like a really bad career move. So anyway, that's what happened.
So now we know why he was Buffalo Bill.
Well, you know what? Yeah, you know what motivated the Buffalo Billing.
Got it. Cool. What you got?
From Rachel. Does your songwriting support your family, or could it support a family? Do you ever think that this would be something that you could earn a living at? Or was it just for fun because you enjoyed it or you were passionate about it?
It's a good question. I see a lot of speculation online, like financially. Decorum dictates that you don't sort of answer unless you're the president of the United States. You're supposed to state.
Tom, will you release your tax returns? And when?
Yeah.
When I'm elected.
See, when you're elected.
You've already been elected songwriter, so.
Yeah, you are a songwriter.
I promise I'm under audit right now.
Okay, but, later.
But I will release them.
Later.
Yes. But after the audit stops. Did I ever think it would be like something that would support me? No, and I kind of never, I always called it, like put it in the extra column. And I've always had a day job. Always. And whether or not you need it, I needed it, it didn't really matter. It was just sort of what I did. To answer that question from Rachel and Hopewell, correct?
Correct.
Rachel and Hopewell, to answer it, yes, it started as something, it was something that I would do for free. And it's never anything that I expected to support my family. So do it from passion. And that's how you get real good lyrics anyway.
Yeah. You do it all the time anyway.
Do it anyway.
I do it in the car going to the concert. We start riffing and making up usually very silly lyrics.
You think?
Yeah.
You want to
I get really bizarre texts. Let me put it that way. Full-on poem text.
Yeah, and then 6 months later, you're at a fish show.
And you're here. Yeah, right. You hear it again. Wait, like, I recognize
wait,
that.
Wait, I wrote that.
No, and I wrote it.
By the way, I'm not getting anything for this.
Oh, you are.
You get a Lamborghini.
There's a beer in your hand, motherfucker.
And a Lamborghini.
And a Lamborghini.
If it hits number one.
I forgot about the Lamborghini.
Yeah, we always had that rule.
Yeah.
If it hits number one,
you're going to get
on the British pop charts, you get the Lamborghini.
What do you got?
I don't know. There's a lot of questions, man. Look at that question.
That's too long.
You can't read that. What's the gist of it?
I can't even read it.
Gist it out.
Gist it out.
Just go ahead and gist it right out.
It's Tom. I'm just often curious about how the band feels about the Gamehenge suite of songs and stories. I've been seeing the band since 92. Ups and downs, growth, etc. I guess just no, it's not even. It's not
well, no, I'll answer that. I'll take a stab at that one.
Yeah. Do you think a true Gamehenge set will ever be played again? Would you geek out as hard as I would?
I would geek out. I love Gamehenge. I always have. But I think from the point of view of the other band members, it's something that was a little bit like it was so kind of Trey's thing. I mean, of course, they were the backup band on that beautiful senior thesis that we all know so well.
Yeah.
And of course, it was kind of like this cool religion that the band was equally part of, you know, that made Phish like this cool thing. Like you could, they were already sort of a bottomless well of discovery. You could dig deep into the music. Some of the lyrics were cryptic, something weird. And then all of a sudden you discover, wait, there's this, they have a religion too?
Yeah, right.
It's like, whoa. I think the band, you know, loves it, holds it in their heart in a special place. But I do also feel that they probably kind of got tired of playing it, just like wouldn't want to make it the big thing about Phish, because it's not. The big thing about Phish is their incredible uniqueness as a band and their ability to play so well night after night and come up with amazing new music too all the time. So that's looking backwards, and they don't want to get caught in the past.
Oh. Now, earlier, you actually didn't answer something earlier.
Okay,
what was that? I'm curious. Do you make requests, and do you have any cool stories of those requests being honored?
Tahoe? Yeah, I think the three of us are actually...
I kind of set that up.
Yeah, it happened to the three of us at Lake Tahoe when... shortly before coming on, my phone started buzzing in my pocket, and normally I'd ignore it. Like, normally it'd just be off.
It was literally minutes.
Two,
3 minutes before they
and
hit the
Trey texted me. He's like, what do you want to hear tonight? And that's something that I'll get, you know, 3, 4, 5 hours, like as we're driving into Boston or wherever they're going to play. T-Bone and I'll sometimes get a text like, what do you guys want to hear? We somehow lucked in. And this is turning, you know, making a short story long, but earlier that evening, I tried to pull the Tom Marshall, I'm a special person thing to Phish, saying, could I get some VIP seats kind of thing. I got a bunch of friends, and they kind of looked at me like, you know what, this isn't really our venue, we don't know this venue very well, and we don't really have a whole lot of pull here, it's owned by the casino.
Yeah, it's a casino venue.
Yeah, and you know what? No, we don't have anything. And there was a guy there standing there, kind of his arms were folded, he was kind of smiling. He was like, well, it turns out, actually, we do. We've got a couple high roller suites that are not going to be used.
Yeah, check right. This.
No,
yeah.
High rollers like, are fish heads.
Yeah. Yeah.
What are like, the odds?
Cha-ching.
Yeah. And it was the best.
Sure. He goes, well, will that suffice? Yeah. And I'm like, yeah. Yeah, that's fine. So it turns out that this was basically a parking lot. And above, you know, behind the parking lot was a set of risers, like the bleachers. And then above the bleachers at the very top was like 6 rooms with beautiful chairs, tables, and waitress cocktail service.
Yeah. And we didn't even realize the stuff was free. We're like being cheap. And we're like, yeah. I remember like, you know, do you guys want anything to eat? And we're like, oh, well, we don't know. And then like somehow somebody figured out it was free. Yeah. And then we started ordering everything.
Yeah. Then we got food, alcohol, it was all free. And it was just amazing. God. So I kind of felt like one of those like sort of like almost like privileged potentate standing there, you know, like looking out over the crowd at the minions, because you know, it was probably like some chemical enhancement in my head as well. Mm-hmm. And so when that phone, the text came through from Trey, I like leaned out like the benevolent leader, like,
yeah, what do you want to
like,
hear? Yeah,
what would you guys like to hear from? and sure enough, you know, I made it happen, you know.
Yeah.
What I mean,
like, I think we threw out 5 songs,
yeah,
and he played 4 of the 5.
He did.
In the first set.
And as you just alluded to, the unreal thing was the girl right below me, as I said that, immediately said Camel Walk.
Right. Yes.
And it turned out that's what they opened with.
Yes. Right. 3 minutes later.
And she looked at us.
3 minutes later, amazing. Fish played Camelot.
How'd you do that?
Amazing.
And then
who are you?
A second weird thing was that her name was Camelot. Like, she goes by Camelot.
I thought, really? I'm pretty sure I named her Camelot. And Hunter and I named her Camelot.
Oh, okay. Yeah. All right. Oops. Sorry.
But she took to it right away. She's like, yes, that's perfect. I'm Camelot. So literally, I'll see her years later now and be like, hey, Camelot. How's She's it Camelot. Going?
Yeah. Plus, we also, like, we reached our hand down and pulled people up into that special
And handed drinks down all night.
Yeah, we handed drinks down. So we're friends still with Nima. Nima, how are you?
She did walk funny.
Like a camel?
She did, yeah, a little bit like a camel.
Dromedary or what's that other kind?
What, that double humped one?
Singletary or double dairy?
Double dairy.
I don't know. Now, let me introduce the people in the room a little bit better here. So, Scott Gray is the person on my left, and he is known on Fantasy Tour as 6/22/94, which is a show date where he met the love of his life and had an amazing experience. You know, apart from that, I think that was like the cherry on the top of an amazing experience.
Yeah.
But he's also very well known for lots of stories like, I suck at jobs. I suck at fill in the blank.
Basically, I suck.
I suck. At and hilarious stories that have come back. I've seen them now. Someone saved them, thank goodness, because they're back. And then another thing that Scott is known for is sort of being one of the primary agitators behind the Ross Compressor thing. So when Fish came back in
2009
in 2009 at Hampton, a few people heard a difference in Trey's sound, and sort of it became this big sort of debate on Fantasy Tour that the reason was that he's no longer has the Ross compressor in his rig. And sure enough, you know, people took pictures of it and determined, you know what, it's missing, and that might be the thing missing. Meanwhile, Trey was experimenting, and so it was, you know, perfectly valid that he left it out here and there and was doing different things. He had his Ross compressor, but the message that the audience sent to the band, to Trey, was, let's, you know, try the Ross compressor again.
Oh, well, here's how this went down. Okay, so basically, I'm on Fantasy Tour, and this is from 2003 until 2009. On Fantasy, there was these guitar geeks, and they were following Tab around and Trey around, all that kind of stuff. He still wasn't using a Ross compressor, and they were just really pissed off about it. Like, they just really, they felt like everything was wrong now that this Ross compressor wasn't in there. Now, I didn't hear the difference, to be honest. Like, I loved it. I didn't care, okay? But I did care that they cared. And then, like, so you were on a thread on Fantasy Tour, and one of those guitar geeks came over and asked you a question, said, would you ask Trey if he's going to bring the Ross compressor back? And I remember you were very polite. You were like, you know what? I'm seeing him tomorrow for a songwriting thing. And like, I'll ask him. You came back the next day. And you're like, I asked him, and it was really strange that, you know, he thought it was strange I asked him. I never asked him about his equipment ever, right? And he thought that was pretty strange. But he said, I've been thinking about bringing that back. Now Fish is coming back. If I can find it. If I can find it. And I went, wait a minute, like, why are we leaving this to chance? You know, like, what, really? This is the only thing between these geeks and their happiness and you'd like to. So I went on.
And you imagine this, like, Hannibal Lecter style, like, garage full of, like, guitar relics. You
know? And he can't, there's no way he can find
there's
it.
There's no way he'd find
there's
it.
There's no way. He doesn't
there's
know
like
where
a
this
severed
thing is.
Head in there.
Yeah. It's like, right, exactly.
It's an old Mercedes with, a, you know, a woman's skeleton.
He has no clue. Like, what
are
like?
The Ross compressor's under the woman's skeleton.
I was thinking.
That's still where it is.
Thank you. That's what I was thinking. So then I was like, I immediately went to eBay and found one. It was like $300. I bought it. I came back to the thread and was like, guys, Christmas was coming up. They announced in 2008, late 2008, Christmas coming up. I go, we're getting him a Christmas present. It's this Ross compressor. Everybody wants in, you know, send me an email and you get to be on the card. You get to put your name on the card. And they
somehow PayPal'd you enough money?
Yeah, they PayPal'd me.
So you got paid back.
I got paid back, and we collected enough money. On the bottom of that Ross compressor, we put... I had everybody choose what are we going to engrave on the bottom of this thing. And we laser color engraved a fish logo, and I let that group then vote on what the phrase was, and it was, "And when the moment comes," from Walls of Cave, is on the bottom of that Ross compressor that he got. I don't know the lyrics.
Know it, I wrote it.
Know it, I wrote it. It's "And when the moment comes."
And when the moment comes to read the words that I engrave.
You'll find so that's why it was, because we engraved.
Got it. That's really amazing. I've always just been telling part of the story. You really filled in.
Yeah.
The approach.
Yeah, and so then
I always had the landing.
Yeah, we said yeah, and that's how I met you, right? Because we had to actually deliver this package to Trey.
Yeah.
I don't have his address. I don't know where he
right.
And so I had to get a hold of you. Well, I wasn't even sure it was you. Like on a PT, you could be anybody and just, pulling my leg, which is very typical. So I remember I texted you on MySpace. Okay? Your Amphibian page on MySpace.
I had Amphibian.
To see if it was you.
And to
it
was prove
you.
That it was me. Yeah, was that's right. I had to verify.
And that's how we met.
Right. And then, just to complete the loop, I gave it sort of very publicly, because I took pictures of it.
Yeah.
I gave it to Beautiful. Trey. He was amazingly thrilled. He wrote a letter to Fantasy Tour in thanks, and I took a picture of that and read it, So that was great.
Which was hilarious, because basically he said he was really excited about it, and he wanted to go over to the studio to check it out if he could find his vintage Maserati.
Right. Implying.
Right. We need to get him.
Please.
We need to get him a Maserati so he can try the damn thing out.
That's funny.
He's got him a Maserati. Scott, can you, not to beat a dead horse, but can you also tell the amazing thing that almost happened?
That almost happened?
That almost was regarding the Triple Wings.
Okay. So after the Ross compressor thing, I got kind of, I was excited about doing things for the community and really making things happen. And I was, after 5 years of no fish, I was really excited that they were coming back. Really excited to come back. And I just remember at Coventry, a very poignant and yet depressing, but moment was when, Trey grabbed the trampolines after Yam and passed them to the audience, and they were basically completely destroyed, the people
not destroyed but disassembled.
Disassembled and to keep. It wasn't destroyed, but disassembled. But it was like, we don't need these anymore.
They're yours.
They're yours. Okay.
Yeah.
Now, and it was I teared up.
It was a beautiful moment.
It was very poignant.
And
I remember that, and really it really stuck with me. And so I thought, you know what, man, they're coming back, and what we need to do is the audience needs to give them back. The audience needs to give those, pass them up through the audience and have the audience give them to them. So I bought some trampolines, and I have a friend on PT who lives within blocks of Hampton Coliseum. So I said, oh, look, I've got these trampolines. We have to get them inside the building. Right, the plan was not let anybody in the fish community, in the fish management, know we're doing this. Okay, and so I just wanted to get them in the building, and then we could handle get into the audience, whatever. Well, he ends up going over there, and then the manager, he ends up talking to the manager of Hampton. He talks to Langstein, and Langstein says, "You know what? You bring them over. I'll bring them in." So we got the trampolines in.
The idea was that the fans would be giving
when Yam starts, we give the crowd the trampolines in the back of the auditorium
and
they pass them up to the stage.
Oh my god!
Back at them, here you
it
need these.
It would have been
back.
Amazing.
Oh, it would have been rock and roll moment of all time. Yeah, absolutely.
It would have been incredibly stunning.
Absolutely.
And
absolutely.
There was some backstage disconnect. I'm not going to say any names.
I won't either.
Right.
But there was definitely a disconnect.
Something happened and they wound up then just staying backstage, right?
No. They the trampolines I bought, they brought out on stage.
Oh.
But then
without giving them to the crowd.
For
without,
yeah. And I actually asked for them back because I was like, that's not the way I wanted them to be delivered. I didn't get them back, but it's okay.
So the band's bouncing on your trampoline.
It's okay. But, you know, but here's the thing. Like, I had, like, there were like hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people kind of that knew about this and kind of involved.
Right.
Okay. And like, once Yem started, we were all pretty excited. Like, holy crap, this is going to be an awesome moment. They're going to pass these up. And, you know, and then some guy instead, brought him up on stage like
dudes,
normal. And,
yeah, just like, some dudes bring him on stage. I think it's Brian and Dickie, actually.
Yeah, probably. I was still happy. It was a good yam.
Yeah. That would have been incredibly poignant.
It would.
That would have been amazing.
Yeah.
All right, hit me with another question, my friend.
Oh. What was the inspiration for the lyrics of Cavern?
Well, I probably shouldn't even answer because I'm about to interview Scott Herman.
Won't that lead up?
Okay. So in a lead up to the interview I'm about to do with Scott Herman, the inspiration, that's actually hard to put your finger on. But I'll tell you the context that was occurring at the time.
Okay.
And then maybe you can figure out the inspiration somehow from that. So imagine two computer programmers in a absolute virtual sea of cubes of programmers. It was like one of these AT&T moments where there are literally 600 programmers. Every one of them like vying for, everyone, like, they were segmented into groups, and we would have these meetings and division meetings and manager meetings and crap. But for the most part, we were just like set adrift in our cubes to program. And you had like this project list in front of you that you had to, your various tasks.
I think a lot of our audience members can relate.
Okay. So anyway, I was a cube guy, cube surfer. And there was this one guy that you could tell who the productive people were because lines would form in front of their cubes of people asking questions.
Right.
And Scott Herman was one of those. He was like one of the like more senior guys and sort of like the smart guy that knew what was happening with this big system. It was like a financial system. I don't know. I worked on it, but I couldn't tell you what it did. I was of the mind that I could not come to work or come to work, and it wouldn't make a difference.
Wasn't it you would come to work and you would just write lyrics?
Well, that's what we're building to. That's what it is.
That sounds awesome.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, and that's probably why I had to move from job to job every 2 years. But as far as Cavern goes, that was one of our first. I think our very first was Squirming Coil.
Squirming Coil.
Yeah, Squirming Coil, where I said that Squirming Coil of Sunset, I keep from Satan's reach. Trey changed that to I keep within my reach. But I keep from Satan's reach, tried yesterday to get away and hitchhike to the beach. And then Scott replied, I saw Satan on the beach trying to catch a ray.
So wait, you're writing email? You're like,
yeah,
like
we're
across,
sending
that within
across,
the
across the so hall. You're in the office.
Across the office.
You got your cubes from and you're like sending them email because you're bored. And you're like, here,
check from one cube to another.
And then he's sending you back stuff.
Yes. Yeah. So Squirming Coil being our first, and it took him like a day or two to respond. And I found out later that he was actually really puzzled by that email that I sent him. And I thought I may have made a faux pas, him being sort of a senior guy. Yeah. Like sending him this weird thing.
Yeah.
Because my mind was just like, I couldn't sit there and do programming.
Right.
So I was like writing shit left and right. Yeah. And I'm a collaborative person. So I like sending shit to someone.
Yeah.
And like email was actually fairly new. So like inter-office email, you had to send it to someone, you know, within the office.
Yeah.
I couldn't think of anyone outside the office to send it to. So of course I sent it to Scott. And then it took him a few days, and then he came back with, I saw Satan on the beach trying to catch a ray. He wasn't quite the speed of light. The Squirming Coil got away.
Wow.
Right.
Wow.
And then we did Lawn Boy, but sadly his half of Lawn Boy, which I couldn't recite right now, didn't make it into the song. Like Trey was just happy with the little part that I did. But then Cavern was kind of like one of our masterpieces, where Trey just loved it. And that was one of those things where Scott initiated that. He sent it to me. The time is clear. The time is near. The mission's clear. It's later than you think. Before you slip into the night, you want something to drink.
Yeah.
And he sent me those, that couplet. And then I answered in a couplet. But then we decided, let's mix it up. Like, I'll send the first line of a couplet. And so we changed everything you can change. Like, who's the initiator? Who's the answerer? And even we divided the couplets up. So by the time we were done, we'd done every sort of permutation of who sends, who receives, who answers, who questions.
Cool.
And yeah. So by the end of that thing, and it was written over the course of one day, but we would we'd send the email. And that was like the official record. And then we'd like run to each other to the window and like giggle and then like go back and like, and I would say, okay, all right, I'm going to send it to you now. So go back. So he'd run back.
And remember, this is during work.
This is during work. Yeah. And so that's how we made work of that. That's probably
and it's lunch.
AT&T stock went down at the time.
Fishes went up though. So who cares? We got Tebow. Got another question from our...
I did have one. Trey has been singing your words for over 30 years. When do you sit down... Oh, when you sit down to write lyrics, do you hear his voice in your head?
That's interesting. I've always said that, like, my poems... have three stages of life, like of birth. Like this is getting probably too deep for a very simple question, but I'm gonna go deep just to answer. So like the first birth of a poem is when you create it. Like I write it to myself, and if I like edit it and whatever, and I say it's done, then it's done. The second is if Trey like says, well, let's turn this into a song. And we turn it into a song. So that's two. The third is if it actually makes the leap from being a song that Trey and I wrote to being a Fish song.
Oh, right.
So because my poems have to run this sort of tight gauntlet before they become Fish songs, I sort of, and this answers your question now, Tebow, I don't hear Trey singing it. I'm still writing it for me.
But, okay.
Yeah. So that's my answer. I'm writing it for me.
Awesome.
But there have been, in the past, certain songs you've written, well, you're with Trey, so he's in your head.
Oh, right.
And that goes to this question about...
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, if we're in the middle of songwriting, and he says, well, we need a chorus here. This is all verses.
Which is part of, that's one of the questions someone wrote, that you, when you show up on a trip to write songs, I've lost it. Do you come with lyrics or do you make them up on the spot with Trey? And I know the answer is both, right?
The answer is both, yeah. And the funny thing, the timing of this interview that we're doing right now is kind of funny because on Friday I go to the Jersey Shore and the house, and they're probably right now filling it with equipment.
Getting it ready.
And getting it ready for us to do a two-day writing session.
2 days?
Yeah.
So in 2 days, what are you going to accomplish in 2 days?
Like, So we'll write Saturday and Sunday, and we'll probably get there Friday. So it'll be, two nights and a full day Saturday. Like Friday night, a full Saturday, and then Sunday morning. And then we always incorporate the listening party.
So you're not just writing, you're making demos.
Well, right. That's our method, is that we're actually writing songs, right? So
Okay. So
we have pretty sophisticated recording equipment, although we keep it not sophisticated to limit us. In other words, we could have like a 64-track studio there, but we would never, ever finish a song.
Right.
So we just limit ourselves to 8 and sometimes 16 at the most tracks, because when we fill them, we never bounce. We never do overdubs. We never bounce. We fill the tracks, and then we move to the next song. And that's the only way we keep going. Otherwise, Trey would go, you know what? I can beat that. or Tom, you know what? You can beat that vocal. Why don't you sing that again?
Right.
Or if you
how great did this sound on this track?
Yeah. Or you know what? Like you played that on that weird piano voicing. Why don't you change that to a clav? Let's hear how that sounds. And when you're in a studio, you have the luxury to do that.
Oh, right.
But
we
just fill up the tracks and move on. And that's how.
But back to the question, so this Friday, you're going to bring lyrics that you've been doing for the last
month or two. Now, do you have melodies in mind ever?
No. Well, okay. So I just sent Trey, which is actually, this is a new addition to our method, is that we're doing email stuff now. So I'll email him an MP3 of a song that I put together. Because I've gotten into podcasting so much, I have this studio constantly set up where I can press a button and I have my keyboard next to me. If I come up with a musical idea now, rather than sort of hum it into my voice recorder I used to do, now I actually just play it and put it down, and it's a little bit more pro.
Okay.
So I have three or four songs that I've emailed Trey, and they're like beginnings of songs.
Yeah, yeah, right.
And the last one, remember how, Tebow, we were at the show in Northampton where Trey was doing Trey Acoustic?
Yeah.
And he said, you guys should read The Secret Life of Trees.
Yeah.
I wrote this song, and I don't think he influenced me to do it, but he said, because it has something about the message in the leaves.
Right.
The wind is whispering through the leaves, the message, something, something.
Right.
And he goes, Tom, this is The Secret Life of Trees. Have you read it? And I said, no. And he goes, well, I'm going to bring you a copy of the book, because you have to read it, because this reminded me exactly of that. Right. So we have that song kind of already working.
But then, from what I know about those trips through the years, you'll also... two of you will just come up with something, especially Friday night, come up with something funny or just amazing. Just you'll just be riffing and you'll write a song right there, like Cook Cabin,
because
you saw something on the wall, or This is a farmhouse.
This is a farmhouse. As we have the walk-in song, which comes that's
right
pure
away.
Spontaneity. Plus Trey often, he'll kind of, he's got this incredible memory for lyrics where he'll sort of glance through a sheaf of lyrics, and I might have 14 poems, and he'll sort of immediately draw impressions like, no, 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 yes, no, no, yes, yes. And so we'll do the four yeses, and then rather than go back and try to salvage a no, he'll kind of just sort of put them aside. And so that's our, goodbye to pre-written Tom songs. Now we're into new territory, and Trey loves new territory. So he'll say something like, all right, why don't we write one? Here you go. I've been working on this. And that's how Winter Queen and Frost, he just said, why don't you write, And I was sitting next to a river, and that's how Frost was under ice upon the river.
You know,
with one last attempt to deliver, the message was lost because of the frost, blah, 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 whatever. And it's kind of and then Winter Queen, the same thing, the Summer Queen. It was all sort of, it was happening right on the spot. And I remember Trey's guitar sitting, playing beautiful guitar behind me is the soundtrack as I'm writing. And there's no pressure. He's he and I have this amazing, he'll never say, Tom, hurry up. I need lyrics. He'll just keep playing guitar and he'll play all day. Like if I just sat there as a challenge, he would just
and not doing anything.
I wouldn't do anything. But he knows what I'm doing is frantically, based on that melody, trying to come up with something.
Yeah.
And because then after a verse or two will have appeared, and then I'll go, I got it. Turn around beaming. And he sometimes will also go, wait a minute, I also got it. He'll have done something too.
Really?
And so I have this competition. And sometimes, we'll do this thing why don't you record your thing? Because I have a thing and I don't want your thing.
You want to mess each other up.
Yeah. So I'll go into a different room. He'll record a thing and then we'll kind of sometimes combine it. Yeah.
Well, cool. The most famous of those, the spontaneity songwriting, obviously would be Farmhouse. You mentioned you walked in and there was a note from a maid who probably deserves some royalties down the line.
Yeah.
Because she actually wrote the first verse.
You're not the first person to have said that. So we pulled up to that farmhouse. This is one of the 96, 97 Stowe, Vermont farmhouses. And on the way there, Trey and I did see the Northern Lights. My first time ever. And so that was in my head. And some other things were in my head from that drive there. Because the drives there are a hugely fun thing, too. Because Trey's kind of a strange driver. He's an incredible athlete.
Some reason he can't do.
Sometimes break like, and he tries to do gas. Seven things at the same time, and driving becomes neglected. And it's, you know, he's always going fast, and Vermont isn't known for every one of its roads being paved. So, you know, anyway, that leaves the door open for some interesting stuff. But we arrived at this farmhouse, my head brimming with ideas. Paul and Carini were just leaving, and Paul said, before we leave, you know, we set up the whole thing. There's a bass station. There's a guitar station. There's two vocal stations for you, Tom. You can choose these two mics. There's a station near the keyboards for you guys, and there's some drums. We got some percussion set up and bongos, blah, blah, blah. And you know what? Why don't you test each one? And I was kind of just like, I don't know what to do. And Trey just said, okay. And he jumped onto like the keyboards and started playing. And then he jumped on the guitar and started playing and was like, and so I immediately like ran to the recorder because I realized there's actually a song sort of being constructed here. Right. So like rather than let whatever he was doing disappear, we recorded it and kind of was overdubbing. And so then finally Trey goes, the only thing we haven't checked was the mics. So Tom, and then he rewound and pressed go. And I'm like, fuck, I don't know what to say. You know? So I grabbed this note that the cleaning lady left. And
really?
I'm like, yeah. And I was just like, welcome, this is a farmhouse.
No way.
We have cluster flies. And then I added, alas. That's
your lyric.
I added alas.
So you helped her out in the first verse.
Yes, I helped her out in the first verse. Right.
Because it was literally she felt talking bad about that there was the cluster flies all over the freaking place. And
which we had no fucking idea what it
is. What the hell is a cluster fly?
Well, that's the thing. I think a lot of people know now that it's a type of fly. But yeah. At the time.
Alas. So, sillily enough. Is that a word?
Sillily.
Sillily enough.
Yes. Or it's a lyric.
Right there, I have Aaron Wolf's and my first version of Wilson.
Yeah.
That Aaron and I wrote. I also still own that note that the cleaning lady left.
Really?
Yeah, and I've seen it as recently in this house as 5 years ago. I don't know where it is.
It's in the...
I don't know right now where it is.
I know, but I think it's in the back there.
But I found it.
It's going to be in my pocket.
Well, it's going to go... That's where it's going on eBay.
It's already...
It's going on eBay.
After this podcast,
it's going on eBay.
I took it 5 years ago.
Oh, you took it 5 years ago? Okay, well...
The last time we saw it.
That's right. But wouldn't you say...
I'm just going to write a no one.
All you eBay bidders out there. Wouldn't you guys...
Oh, here it is.
Wouldn't you guys think like that would be worth roughly, you know, between $1,500 and $1,700?
Yes.
Yeah. As a first bid?
No, $15 to $17.
Yeah, I was going to say $17.
$17, not $1,700.
Right.
All right.
I'll give you
$18. Yeah. $1,800. Do we have $1,900, ladies and gentlemen?
To go back to something earlier, talking about the show, the size of crowds, and you can edit this out if you want. And you mentioned Aaron Wolf, and Aaron wrote this song, Wilson, with Tom in eighth grade. And who else?
Aaron wrote Wilson with just me and him.
Okay.
And Aaron wrote Golgi with
Then Bob we Zuda. Lost track of Aaron.
Yeah.
And so the last time, at one point, Aaron had seen Fish, I think, in a bar with, you know, 27 people. And then not until I think it was the Clifford Ball. And he arrived late. He came in through the backstage area. I met him, brought him back, brought him to you. And band was just going on for that beautiful 4 o'clock set, you know, that first set.
Yeah.
That's sunlight out. And we go up on the scaffolding and he looks out and he's like, holy fuck. This is
amazing.
He literally saw 80,000 people or whatever the number is. Last time he'd seen Fish, it was 27
people.
Because he had disappeared for that long period of time.
Wow.
He did, but I do remember, I thought what you were going to say, so that might have been the second time like that he had gotten a clue of, I don't think he knew how big, like no one knew how big those crowds would be, but I do remember that he had told me a story that he either was listening to someone's tape.
Yes, in L.A.
And it was Golgi. And he was like,
and he wrote it.
And he was like, I wrote this shit. What the hell? And someone was playing
and
like the new
like,
big thing.
Sure you were.
Yeah.
Sure you wrote
yeah,
this.
Right.
Like, no, that yeah, he right. was in L.A. He was a filmmaker.
Yeah,
and he was in L.A. Yes. And they were at a party, and there was someone threw some fish on, and it was, he's like, I wrote this.
I wrote this.
I wrote this song. And then Wilson was like, I wrote this in 8th grade. And everyone's like,
yeah. Okay, right. Yeah, okay, thanks, Aaron. Yeah, right.
So anyway, by the way, Aaron had some fame. He ran for a congressional seat in
upstate New York,
the Albany district or whatever of New York or Saratoga area. And then he didn't win that. But prior to that, he also had some fame as a filmmaker, and he did the movie King Korn, which a lot of people have seen.
Yeah.
And it's especially relevant today because it has a lot of like climate statements in it. And also,
and we're basically made up of corn syrup.
Yeah. All it's kind of like what the subsidies that the corn farmers get, and like, you know, at the expense of other growers and other crops. And it's just kind of almost like a hideous thing that he sort of exposed. It was interesting.
Whoa, Aaron Wolf. Check him out.
Yeah, yeah. Check him out. Aaron Wolf, ladies and gentlemen.
How you doing, Aaron?
Can we go have Thai food now?
Is typhus? Too early?
Typhus? We have typhus now?
Typhus.
Can we have some Thai food?
Typhus.
I didn't have meatballs like you guys. Like you meatballs.
You're a little bit hungry? No more questions? Look at these
There's
questions.
Plenty of questions. There's like thousands. We don't have to do it all now.
Oh, we don't have to do it all now. You're right.
So I think we did pretty well.
I think fantastic.
We have a lot of...
Like
a
fantastic. Lot of, you have a ton really of... The only other question is like, I actually think...
Right, do one more question.
Here's the deal.
One
more question.
Oh, yeah. That's fine. It's not that long.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Okay.
Although he might... He'll say no.
I could
if he doesn't want to do it. But it's a great question. It's a great story because, again, we talked about briefly earlier that it's not about Trey and Tom. Yeah,
exactly.
It's about Tom and Phil DiMiattia. Yes. But I think you've talked about this before.
I may have told it. Let's go ahead.
Did you? Have you told about Ghost?
I thought you did somewhere else.
I feel I've never told you
the story of the Ghost. All right, set that back up.
No, look. Look, because I certainly had the, you know, I had, you know, I assumed you were the ghost to Trey. And right. I think a lot of people
I think everyone would assume that.
I think most people.
Nowhere in the story does it say anything, but it's just too much wishful thinking.
You know? It's like
it's more Tom's.
It's like Trey singing about you. But you know, I actually think the real story is great.
And I'm willing to tell it again because I think it did actually, I think even on my podcast, it came out, but it was on my intro podcast.
Okay.
Which no one's listened to. That one, it's called Let's Take a Ride, which I take with me and my producer. I do a drive through Princeton Day School. That one, like, no one's listened.
That's what it was.
No one's listened to it.
I didn't hear it.
No one's listened to it. I don't know why. It's episode 000.
So well, that's
like,
why.
Yeah, maybe it's like the one to ignore or something. I think it's a good episode. But in any case, I will say it again. So, a really incredibly good friend of mine. To set the stage a little bit, basically Trey was in public school at Princeton, and I was in public school, both from, you know, working class parents, no real money here, and both, I think, of our families at the same time kind of hit a little prosperous streak. Enough so that both of our parents thought, you know, let's send our slightly underperforming sons to private school because we hear it's better, right? So I wound up in private school, Princeton Day School, I think Trey had arrived a few years prior to me. So I show up in 8th grade at Princeton Day School. And immediately, there's all these events for new students, and I kind of really incredibly connected with this guy, Phil DiMiattia, and he's a wonderful, amazing, warm, incredible human. Love Phil so much. And he's now in Maine, and he's like working for the National Park Services, and he's in charge of amphibians. All the amphibians in Maine.
Really?
Which is awesome.
That is awesome.
So, hey, Phil, how are you? But, so, and he and I have a remarkably different take on this story. And I don't
That's
even
what's
know.
So great about
yeah,
it.
Yeah, and I don't even know if he really knows how much, and he, you know how different it is. And maybe this will be the sort of eye-opening for him. But, because if I repeat it enough, maybe it'll get to him in Maine, you know, out in the woods. Maybe he'll be listening, you know, on his iPhone. I hope you're listening, Phil. And I love you, Phil. And it's just such an incredible time for me. But we both needed support. We both needed a friend. and we turned to each other, and we were both, I think, rewarded by like an incredibly sort of, but for me in Phil, an incredibly like almost like a mirror, like thinking the same things I'm thinking. Like we're going through this weird time trying to be the new kid at Princeton Day School, and every time, like, he was just an incredible support system for me, and I hope I did the same for him. But we kind of at the same time were going through, you know, eighth grade, and like we shared some of the same experiences, like first girls, first anything, lots of firsts, yes. Right?
Yeah.
And you know, we were really close. We were together every weekend. We were together all the time. I was at his house or he was at mine. We went on vacations together. He went on vacations with my family. I went on vacations with his family. We had another friend, Dan. We went skiing with Dan's family. So we were always, always together. And one of our firsts was smoking weed. And neither he nor I took to it very well. We both were almost overdosed by it. Like it was almost too much. Like it was too much of a new thing. And I remember one time we were at a party and it just kind of hit me really, really hard. And I was kind of sort of, you know, walking around and my friend Mark was doing some antics. And Phil was always kind of the guy who's like kind of, you know, could calm me down and make everything fine. So I left out a part of the story, and that is that time in my life was a little bit tumultuous. I would also talk kind of, I would pray in a weird way to this thing called a spirit. I had this little secret in my life where I would sort of like sometimes at night I would sort of say things out loud thinking it was being heard by someone, and it would alter the course of my life in different ways. I would sort of ask for things or just say things, and then I would go to sleep or whatever. It was kind of like praying.
You say it out loud, though.
I would say it out loud.
It's not just in your head. We all do this in our head.
I would mouth it. No, I would mouth it. And I really was thinking, and that the thing that I was saying it to, because I definitely didn't have a concept of Jesus or God or anything Christian at all, but it was definitely something called my spirit. So now, fast forward to me and Phil getting stoned at parties together, and, you know, having this really cool kinship. And all of a sudden, Phil noticing my discomfort at one point, like I kind of wanted to leave because I got too stoned. He came up to me and he said, "Hey, Tom, everything's fine. And I just want to let you know, I'm allowed to tell you that I am your spirit."
Wait. He just said this out of the blue, and you never said anything about this to him?
Nothing. I would never have told anyone that. And I was just like, kind of like, it was like a lightning bolt went through me. I was just like, this explains a lot about our friendship. And yet, how did he know, and what the fuck? Like, more what the fuck than anything.
Right, yes. Okay.
Right? So, you know, then the next day at school, I said, "Phil, do you have a second? Can we..."
Aren't you in the urinal or something?
Yeah, or like, yeah, we're like at free time at Princeton Day School or at, you know, whatever, recess or whatever it's called. And I said, you know, "What was that about, that spirit thing?" And he goes, "Don't worry about it. I can't talk about it."
What? Oh, my God.
And,
oh, my God.
And it didn't just happen once.
Right.
It didn't just happen once. We achieved that, you know, different state a few more times. And almost every time he would sort of make some reference to being my spirit. And he's got me kind of thing. And
you think your room was bugged and he was bugging your room? Or?
I don't think I spoke that loud.
Okay. Wow.
But I was pretty certain that this guy was copping to the fact that he was the guy I was talking to.
Yes. Of course.
Had been before I even knew him.
He's the ghost.
He is. He's the ghost.
Yeah. So to Trey, I said, "I feel I've never told you the story of the ghost." And that was about Phil.
Got it.
Right. Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
That's cool.
And so later in life, you know, much later, so now we're 30 and I think we're having our first kid. Phil comes by and he and I are both dragging our kids in sleds through a beautiful, it's called Spruce Park, Quarry Park in Princeton. And it's one of the rare times Phil comes to see his parents in Princeton because he lives in Maine. And he's got a newborn and I've got a newborn and it's a wonderful moment and we're walking and I decide to broach that again. And I said, "Hey, Phil, you know, you really like kind of, you know, really altered my existence by admitting that you were my spirit. And you know, it really meant a lot to me. And I really wanted to get to the bottom of this because you never really sort of provided me a satisfactory answer. So why don't you tell me now kind of what you meant by that and how you became my spirit. And kind of he looked at me and goes, Tom, you and I had a great friendship. And
we had crickets.
We had a really, really incredibly amazing time together. And you were always there for me. And I like to feel like I was there for you. And but you know, but you've asked me the spirit thing before. And really
it didn't exist.
Your death is like.
Oh my God. Is that incredible?
Yes.
And I love him to this day. And yet I know that he did house my spirit. He did. He did. There's no way that he didn't.
There's no way.
Maybe he didn't know that he did.
I see. Right. Well, okay. Right. The spirit.
That's fine.
Okay.
Yeah.
The spirit, like maybe he just, you know, he was using him.
Yeah.
Could have been.
And that's what he does.
Okay.
And, you know, he might be out there waiting in the wind and rain. I simply haven't looked.
Awesome. Awesome.
Love you guys. Let's go eat Thai food.
There you have it.
Yeah. Thank you for this interesting new take.
Can we do more?
Yeah, we're going to do more. Sitting on this, unfortunately, Scott, because you live in California, you're probably not going to be rotated in as often as I'd like, but I'm going to rotate other people in to that slot right there.
Yeah.
And I'm going to be doing this probably once a month, I think.
Yeah, just because it's
Q&A.
It's really cool.
Because we just hit, that might have been 6 questions.
Out of,
and I think I got 300 or 400.
Yeah.
And I closed that survey after 24 hours.
Right. Yeah. Let's go eat and we'll figure out the rest.
Yep. Anyway.
You're hungry.
Thanks, guys.
Dude, that was awesome.
Hey everyone, thanks for listening to the first Under the Scales Q&A episode. If you've gotten this far, you've probably realized a mistake I made. I forgot to ask people to identify themselves on my first survey where those questions were submitted. Ideally, it would have been nice if I could have said, and here's a question from Roger in Boston, for example. So I apologize to those whose questions I used without identifying you. To avoid this problem in the future, I'll probably have to launch a new survey, and I'll ask you all to resubmit your questions, and this time, there will be a place to enter your information so I can read it when I ask your question. Thanks, and I hope you're enjoying the beautiful spring weather as much as I am. I'll be back next week with Andrea Nusanoff.